It's a brand new week on Political Rewind. We're very glad to have you with us for the show today. As we get started, it occurred to Sam and Tom and I that it's really important for us to make sure everybody understands the schedule for Political Rewind these days. Of course, we're on the air, you know this by now, Monday through Friday, and we're on at 9 a.m. and then again at 2 p.m. But I think it's really worth pointing out to you that the show at 9 is live. The 2 p.m. show is an encore presentation of that show, and we do that because there are an awful lot of people who aren't able to hear us at 9 and perhaps don't subscribe to our podcast or hear us online. And the reason that this morning especially I wanted to mention it is because every now and then, not very often, but every now and then, our schedule puts us in a situation where we get a little behind the news. So Friday, our live show at 9, we reported that looked like President Trump was canceling his visit to Atlanta. Of course, that changed by noon. And so people who heard the show at 2 may have thought, well, we know he's actually coming. That's the situation. 9 a.m. live, 2 p.m. an encore show. Very rarely will there be many changes like the one that we saw on Friday. And we do update the news headlines at the top of the 2 o'clock show, so that at the top of that show, we actually said the president had, in fact, decided he would come to Atlanta. Hope that makes sense, and that you will continue to listen whenever, 9, 2, on our podcast, or wherever you decide to hear the show. All right, let's get started. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, my partner on Mondays and Fridays, is with us. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the AJC, and, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing great.
Yeah.
Healthy,
yeah.
But not so wealthy.
You
and not so wise.
You spent your weekend, you told me, in your wood shop, which is one of your favorite places to be, and you built what?
Just a little platform for our tiny grill, or hibachi.
Oh, very lovely. All right. Also joining us today, Lori Geary. You know her as the host of The Georgia Gang, which airs on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on Fox 5. And, of course, she's the former political reporter for WSB TV. And I'm always struggle just a little bit to describe your company, which is a communications firm.
We're media consultant.
Yeah, but you also produce, right?
Right. We do a little bit of everything. Right now, crisis communications is top.
I'll bet it is.
With everything going on, so.
I'll bet it is. Uh-huh. And you like this life. It's so much. We both understand how nice it is to be freed from the role of political reporter.
It is. It's just, it's a whole different perspective. Yeah. You kind of get the other side, too, now and where they were coming from.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. So thank you for being here. You're just back from your spring vacation, so we appreciate
your
coming in.
Yeah, so please forgive me.
No, you're great. Jeremiah Olney is with us today. He's with Paramount Consulting, and a firm you do, in fact, you do consulting work. You don't have candidates in this cycle at this point, or do you now? The last time we saw you, you hadn't had any.
Yeah, no candidates this cycle so far.
So what does that mean? What are you doing with your time over at Paramount?
Not too much. Well, right now we're mostly focused on the Capitol. Yeah. I mean, crossover days on Thursday, so these next few days are going to be pretty crazy.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit, probably on tomorrow's show. Mm-hmm. There's other issues, and maybe today if we get to it, but thank you for being here. And Brian Robinson is back with us. We always enjoy having Brian from Robinson Republic.
Yes.
He, too, does communications and consulting work. You do have a candidate in this race, at least one, up in the 7th District.
That's right. We're doing some work for Senator Renee Arman, who's also busy with crossover week this week. And then Dr. John Cowan up in the 14th Congressional District from Rome.
Okay.
Who's he's really working hard out there.
And you this weekend told us you went to see one of your favorite country acts at Fox
Theater. I did. I went to see Little Big Town at the Fox.
And they're good.
I'd say any night at the Fox is a good night.
That's true.
It's an Atlanta treasure. And, of course, the two lead women on the Little Big Town are Georgia girls. Yeah. And so I would like to support the hometown acts, you know. So that was really cool. They had a bunch of friends and family from home there. So that's always – it was cool.
All right. Well, I wanted our – I think people need to know a little bit more about everybody personally because we talk politics so much on the show. So thank you all for sharing. All right, let's get right to it. We know that Jim, sometime either late tonight or early tomorrow morning, we're going to see passengers from the Grand Princess, the cruise ship that's been moored off the coast of San Francisco because it's in isolation because of there's some coronavirus cases on board. People are being tested. More will be tested. We know that there are maybe some 30-plus Georgians who have been on that cruise ship. They and others will be coming to Dobbins Air Reserve Base sometime again late tonight or early tomorrow morning, right?
Right, right. 34 Georgians and an unspecified number of other passengers who live up and down the East Coast. It's really been interesting in seeing the contrast that with which Governor Kemp and even local officials like Mike Boyce, the chairman of the Cobb County Commission, have kind of addressed this, especially when you contrast it with President Trump's trip here on Friday. Boyce, for instance, he's got the Cobb County immediately put a YouTube out with an assemblage of local officials and you know began calling these people guests and one of us. They're just like us. He acknowledged the anxiety it was likely to create, but he said we've got to get through it.
Yeah, Lori, Dobbins people, if they're not aware of it, Dobbins has served in this capacity in other instances. The Ebola patients that were flown to Emory all arrived at Dobbins base before being transported to Emory. So it's not something new for them, and they certainly know how to handle the situation.
They do. I can remember the video of those patients, you know, being unloaded. And, I mean, they have the protocols in place. They've had them for some time. They go through training exercises. So there's nobody better to handle these types of cases than the folks at Dobbins. And, this is, I think, what life will be like for the next few weeks, few months, hopefully not, too much longer. But we know that this is real and this is happening, and it's not likely to succeed, even though, what President Trump said on Friday, I think the order of the day is just to be realistic. And, you know, there's a fine line between getting people, you know, in a panic mode and versus just a realistic mode. And I think that Governor Kemp has done a really good job of walking that fine line. And I think in these times, because I'm in this crisis communications mode now and this communications firm, in some ways you can't over communicate in these situations to really put people at ease. And I think that's really important. And to be realistic and to hear that, you know, the test kits are available and they're beautiful and they're perfect. No, you know, I mean, there's still humans that administer these tests and humans are not perfect.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Yeah, Brian, you having served as a communications director for Governor Sonny Perdue, for Governor Nathan Deal. For Governor Nathan Deal, you certainly understand the stress, the pressure that a governor can be under in a crisis like this. And Lori's, I think, right. I think we're going to ask our Democratic friend here, too. But the Kemp administration so far seems to be keeping people on top of this in a very transparent way.
When this first hit a couple of weeks ago, I said on air that Governor Kemp needs to over-communicate, to use Lori's phrase. I said the exact same thing, and in fact needs to communicate every day. And that's what they've been doing. Mm-hmm. And so I give them top marks for staying on top of it. It's also important visually to see him standing beside the president at the CDC. Very important for us to hear from our governor that these people are coming to Dobbins.
I want to talk about that for a second, because I think there's a little dissonance there. Without taking away from the credit that Governor Kemp deserved, the messaging from President Trump, as Lori pointed out on Friday at CDC, was nothing to worry about. right. Don't worry. Yeah. Anybody who needs to get tested can be tested. We're containing the virus. I happen to know a lot about things like this because I have an uncle who was brilliant as a doctor. And there's Governor Kemp standing there having taken a completely different approach to handling this situation. So it's interesting when you say it was a good thing to see him standing with the president. I don't know if I were the governor, I would have wanted to back up a few steps and get out of frame when the president was talking.
Well, a lot of Governor Kemp's base, I mean, maybe all of Governor Kemp's base is President Trump's base. And so President Trump's supporters, who are critical to Kemp's political future, want to see him there. So politically speaking, which is not what we're really talking about here, we're not talking about the politics of it, it was very wise for him to be there. And look, Kemp is saying the right things. No one's like, Kemp looks dumb because he's standing beside the president who's saying things I don't agree with. Okay. No one thinks that.
That's fair.
You know, and look, what the president is doing obviously is not necessarily good medical advice. I mean, the guy's not a doctor and he's obviously not an epidemiologist. But I think what he's trying to do is to prevent panic that hurts our economy further. He's worried about people not flying, people not going to shopping malls, people not going to work. And that's going to make the bottom fall out of the economy potentially, which he obviously is very concerned about. You can see in his messaging, he goes directly at the stock market issue, saying, you know, the media scare is driving down the prices of my market, which is beautiful. It's been great. The markets are strong. So
you're not endorsing this approach, are you?
I'm explaining the approach. I'm explaining the approach. I think he's worried about the economy collapsing at this juncture in an election year.
Jeremiah, let's talk about Kemp, and then please, if you want to weigh in on the president, that's fine. One of the things that, you know, in the statement about the fact that Dobbins is taking in these people from the cruise ship, just one quote from his statement. In the days and weeks ahead, I encourage Georgians to pray for the patients affected by COVID-19 and their healthcare providers. We must continue to support one another, trust the advice of the medical community, and remain vigilant. I was struck by that because it not only speaks to the transparency they've been showing us, but Governor Kemp gave us a somewhat emotional message about this, that we are all in this together in some ways.
Sure. And I give Governor Kemp a hard time, and rightfully so. But in the last couple of weeks, I think he's demonstrated a good amount of leadership on this issue and taking a very measured response in direct contrast to the president. At the same time, I think trying to address this crisis now is difficult when we don't have things like Medicaid expansion. Like, yes, we should trust our medical providers, but there are a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions in Georgia, who are afraid to go to the doctor because if they find out they have coronavirus, then what then? What if they don't have insurance? What if they can't afford treatment even with insurance? I think we have kind of engineered the perfect situation for a crisis like this because people are worried about going to their medical providers.
Yeah.
To the point about Trump, I think that this is a counterproductive effort. I think, if anything, people who are investors, stock market watchers, they will be more panicked when they see a president who fundamentally doesn't understand medical science or the flu or the nature of outbreaks. Like, he has proven that he really has no handle on this situation. He's not even really, it seems to be, trusting his advisors. You don't appoint a vice president who has political experience to oversee a medical response. So I think his response, if anything, is creating less confidence in stock markets and the economy than otherwise.
Jim, we should point out that none of the people who are coming to Dobbins at this point, do we know that they are I don't know that any of them have been tested. They will be tested when they get here. But the point is, we don't have any reason to believe that any are infected with coronavirus at this point.
Right. Exactly. I recall Mike Boyce saying yesterday that they will be monitored. I would assume that they're going to be kept in separate rooms.
Yeah, for about 14 days of confinement, I think.
For 14 days. But, Jeremiah's actually makes a very, very good point. I mean, we've got 1.3 million people uninsured in Georgia. And the problem with and the approach to epidemics is kind of like a blanket. You throw coverage at everything in every little pocket. And so that's going to force some very, very interesting decisions when it comes to medical treatment for a lot of Georgians who don't have it, especially in rural Georgia.
Lori?
Well, I was going to make an observation that we saw the word trust in Governor Kemp's statement, and also you talking about trust in our medical professionals. And I think this is where we're going to rely on, you know, government at its best, right? Like, we need answers. And I think, you know, going back to the over-communicate, when I was in Colorado last week, we were kind of, I call it ground zero for Colorado, because the first case was in Keystone. We were skiing, and it's like, oh, gosh. Well, by the end of that day, we knew when that guy had flown into Denver International Airport. We knew the medical clinic he went to. We knew the condos he was staying at. We had all this information to kind of, you know, quell the panic a little bit. And I think, you know, last week I wasn't here in Georgia, but I was looking, you know, it was Fulton County, and it was a father and a 15-year-old. And I was like, where did the 15-year-old go to school? You know, everybody was searching for answers. And I think that's where, you know, we can get more of a handle on the panic if we have more details and more facts.
You know, it's interesting about that, Jim, apropos of what Lori's saying, we now know that during the CPAC conference in Washington last week, there was one person who attended the conference who, in fact, tested positive for coronavirus. This person apparently did not come into contact with the president or the vice president, but he did, in fact, have direct communications with Matt Schlapp, who is the head, of course, of the organization. And the reason I bring that up today is it kind of speaks to what Lori is talking about. Schlapp has been able to reach out to many of the thousands of people who were there, people in his organization, have been able to see, ascertain what exposure they might have had to the individual. Obviously, the White House is aware. So when it comes to the administration, there seems to be an effort, Jim, to make sure people know about who the victim is and how they might have interacted with him.
All right. Yeah, exactly. And on Sunday, you had Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona announced that they had direct contact with that person, and they were placing themselves in self-quarantine. And then you've got, you know, I know President Trump was on Twitter, as usual, this morning, accusing Democrats of attempting to inflame the situation. But he was supposed to be at a healthcare conference in Orlando today, and that conference has been called off completely.
So, all right, we're going to keep monitoring this thing and see where we head. But just one final statement about this, Brian. Lori said it, and I think we all are aware of it. At least in the next few weeks, lives are going to be radically altered by what we're dealing with right now. There's no question about it.
Well, it becomes a new normal eventually, and people kind of get back on target. So I think, since this is Political Rewind, what does this mean for politics? I don't see it having any impact in the Democratic primary going on right now. It's not really emerging as an issue. But if this impacts the economy, this will be a general election issue moving forward. So there's a chance the economy can suffer a setback like this if we bounce back. It's just like, you know, the ice storms we had in 2014 and 2015. Nobody went to work for a week, but the economy didn't suffer because, you know, we just bunched up the work as soon as it was over. Is that going to happen here, or is it going to be a slower process?
Go ahead.
I think that's really important, because I think that's what we want to hear from the president, that, hey, look, our economy is strong. We're going to weather this. We know that there will be a few bumps in the road ahead. That's what we want to hear, that realistic talk. And I think that's what's really important, is just to hear that messaging from the president, is that it's going to be okay. What I keep hearing on, you know, when I tune into some of the talk shows, is that this is being compared to Katrina, and that's the worst thing that President Trump could be compared to right now, is this is President Trump's Katrina.
Well, and that, Jeremiah, let's talk about it for a couple more minutes.
Sure.
Brian makes a very strong point. Trump touts the economy constantly. It is his main measure of the success he believes he's having as president. And this could be devastating to him in that sense. But leadership, too. I mean, it's going to be interesting to watch to see how his approval numbers tend to trend in the weeks and months ahead, because now is the moment when you prove whether you're a leader or not, and the American public will decide whether or not President Trump has, in fact, been the kind of leader they are looking for in a situation like this.
Yeah, I think really his ability to maintain his approval right now is predicated on two things. He would have to do one of two things to, I think, maintain where he is now. One is to step out of the spotlight, which is not something he's known for doing, or two is to integrate new facts into his worldview, which is also something he's not known for doing. So I don't really see how he can come out of this looking good if he doesn't change a few things that he's doing. And quite frankly, based on the last 3+ years of him in the White House, I don't see any reason to believe that he'll do anything but tweet more about how everything's fine, and that's just going to create more chaos, and he's not going to understand why.
All right, we'll watch how that proceeds. Jim, let me give you the last word before we take a break.
The one thing I disagree with Brian on is that this could very well have an effect on just on the campaign rallies that are going across the country one after another, and even Donald Trump rallies. I mean, yes, he touts the economy, but those rallies that he's held in every state where Democrats have had primaries lately, that if he loses those, that could be a big blow to him.
Boy. That's a really a good point, Lori. You're going to get the last word. We may be seeing here a reshaping of how candidates are going to continue running for not just president, but other offices as well. You know, Bernie Sanders was asked yesterday on Meet the Press if he would cancel the large rallies he intends to hold in the weeks ahead. He wouldn't commit to that. Neither would the Biden campaign. They're all saying, well, you know, we, of course, are concerned about safety first. We've heard no word from the White House, from the president's campaign, rather, about that. But there could be a rethinking of how you run for president.
Well, President Trump did address it, saying, you know, I'm not worried. I'm still going to be out there shaking hands and all of that. But also, if you think about it, how old are these guys?
Yeah.
All of them are in that key demographic where, you know, if you're elderly, you will get hit if you get, you know, the coronavirus harder than most folks who are, you know, so that has to be a concern. I mean, what do you do when you campaign? You're out there shaking everybody's hands and hugging. And I mean, there has to be some protocol. I mean, we sent my daughter's soccer team. They were no longer allowed to high five or, you know, so little things like that are going to change. And how do you campaign in this type of environment? We're going to see.
All right. Yes, we are. We will watch this and continue to cover it here on Political Rewind, as will all of our programs, our news programming here at GPB. Let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. When we come back, qualifying ended on Friday for all the races in Georgia coming up in 2020. There was some really fascinating information that came out of them. Let's talk about that after these messages. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Lori Geary, Jeremiah Olney, Brian Robinson on the show today. Jim, qualifying ended on Friday for all the races in Georgia in 2020. it's always interesting, isn't it, to see people who are already incumbents sort of sitting at the Capitol or close to their phones waiting to see whether they drew an opponent before the noon deadline, and the relief that some of them have and the consternation when others find out they, in fact, are going to face opposition for whatever the race may be. But we had some really interesting developments, I think. I would pick as the first one, but then I'll ask you to pick one yourself. 187 Democrats qualifying for 187 seats in the state legislature. That's a remarkable number, and it sure does show us that Democrats believe they have an opportunity, they're re-energized, they're ready to make some big strides at the Capitol.
Yeah, it's a number we haven't seen out of Democrats since the late 90s, before they lost power. You have 180 seats in the House, and you have another 56 seats in the Senate. And I think if I'm not mistaken, I think in the 2016 or 2018 cycle, you had maybe only 50 of those seats had competitive races where you had a Republican versus a Democrat in November.
Yeah.
So this is really it's really extraordinary.
And yet we also, Brian, have a situation in which the seats that flipped in 2018, the Democrats who won Republican seats in 2018, they've all drawn Republican opponents trying to take back those legislative seats. It all points to a really exciting 2020 in the legislative races, certainly.
I've talked to some of the candidates who are running for those seats, particularly in North Fulton and in Cobb, that flipped. And they feel pretty good about where they stand right now, showing, for example, in their polling that President Trump has a net positive approval rating, which, of course, is the best indicator that we have in today's context for how competitive a seat is. So if Republicans are able to take back even just a few of those that they lost, they will eliminate any hopes the Democrats have of winning back the House and perhaps even not give them any gains at all, which I think most people today are predicting there would be some kind of Democratic gain in the 2020 election. So those few, you know, the ones that Betty Price used to hold, the one that Wendell Willard held, the one that Sam Teasley held, those districts are very competitive.
Betty Price is back. She wants to win.
She's back
that
in
seat
there,
back.
Yeah.
Tom Price's wife, of course. Lori, you know, we all went through this back in 2003 and 2004 when Republicans took control after Sonny Perdue won the governor's race. And here we see it go in the other direction, perhaps.
I remember that night because I was at Phil Gingrey's headquarters. But I think also, though, you have to remember there were, 13 legislative seats that they that Republicans lost 2 years ago. And I think Democrats are looking to capitalize on that momentum. I know Jeremiah will weigh in on that. But also since then, if you're going after that female Metro Atlanta kind of, you know, on the fence vote, you have to remember what passed since then, which was what we term as the abortion bill. But I think that that's going to play a part in this as well. But I also, you can't discount the fact that this is about President Trump.
Yeah.
And, you know,
everything is.
It really is.
Yeah, everything
I mean,
is.
You can't ignore that. And so, you know, you've got to play to that base. And where do those women fall?
Jeremiah?
I mean, I think they fall in the Democratic Party like they did in 2018. I mean, there has been nothing that has changed. If anything, it's gotten worse, the rhetoric and the messaging coming from the White House and the Republicans overall. Generally, they've kind of all come on board with Trump. With the exception of your occasional Mitt Romney's, like no one really comes out and speaks out against even the worst things that Trump says and does. And I was going back and looking at the competitiveness of state races. Generally, Georgia has always been one of the least competitive states in the nation. I mean, we have under half of our seats generally face major opposition party competition. So this is, I think, really indicative of the massive energy that we have now. Even as we're looking at these very gerrymandered seats, we're still saying we have to compete because there's nothing more important right now than taking back the House, taking back the Senate, and getting some sense of rationality back into government.
Yeah, we should point out that 187 races amounts to more than 80% of the total number of seats in the legislature,
and it was,
Brian.
It was 40% in 2018 was how many were competed.
There
in,
you go.
So. Well, it does go to show you to some degree that Georgia is becoming competitive really across the board. I think the 2018 election put to rest any doubt that we are a 51-49 state and getting closer to 50-50. And, of course, those are the hopes that people like Jeremiah are pinning their hearts to. And but look, Jeremiah is wrong that nothing has changed. You look at what the General Assembly Republicans are doing this session to target women and trying to give them issues that they can be supportive of. They have implemented – we have a bill that passed the House that will allow women state employees to take paid maternity leave, which, of course, is a huge step. Ivanka Trump weighed in with a tweet congratulating Representative Houston Gaines of Athens for carrying that legislation.
Via 6 weeks, right?
No, three.
3 weeks. Okay.
Hey, it's a step in the right direction. Hey, yes, and two, you know, Georgia, of course, has a very high maternal mortality rate. And you've seen Speaker Ralston take the lead on making sure that new mothers can stay on Medicaid and get the care that they need. Now it's 2 months. They're going to extend it to 6 months. It'd be great if it could be a year, but the speaker said, hey, let's not look progress in the face and say no because it's not everything you want. It's still going to be a big price tag for the state, but it's Republicans putting resources on issues that women care about.
Lori?
Well, I think there's no more important issue this year. We saw it play out when Lucy McBath took the seat from Karen Handel than health care.
Yeah.
This is going to be the number one issue, and I don't care which side of the debate you are on, which side of the aisle you are on, if you're not out there talking about health care and your access to health care. And I think it will be interesting to see the rural health care issue and how it impacts any of these races. We know that Governor Kemp was so popular, Senator Perdue was so popular in the rural areas, but I'm interested to see how the health care issue will affect some of these races.
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad you point out health care as the issue for Lucy McBath. Because it's easy to misunderstand that she won that race because of her position on gun safety. I mean, that clearly is a big part of who she is. Mm-hmm. But health care is the driving force, I think, that got her where she ended up.
I think so, too. And I think you have to understand that, you know, I'm a suburban mom, right? And I've got kids. And that's a big issue.
So what do you think about
when it comes to health care?
I apologize. Yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off, except in terms of that, what do you think when you hear Brian say, well, so the Republicans have advanced a bill to give maternal leave for state employees. They've got a three-week plan for that. Sharon Cooper is having some success in terms of Medicaid coverage for moms who have just given birth. Are those issues, are they handling it in a way that you think will attract women voters?
Well, I think so, because I think these are philosophical switches that we haven't seen from the Republicans in a long time. So I think, to Brian's point, they are trying. But I also think, you know, there are a lot of women who care about that heartbeat bill, and mm-hmm. they were glad to see that passed, especially the conservative women and Governor Kemp supporters. But I think it's that metro area, the metro Atlanta suburban moms, and, you know, even the metro areas in Savannah and Augusta and all of that, that I like to see play out and see what the results will be.
All right. I want to interrupt for a minute. Jim, in a moment, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on your takeaways from qualifying. But we really need to – there's some very important news developing in New York right now. We're talking to you again. We're live at about 20 to 10 on Monday morning. They have just halted trading on the New York Stock Exchange.
Oh, my.
The market is down 1,884 points. It is probably, we're not, it, among other things, because the oil market has plummeted by some 30%. They've halted trading on the market. Obviously, we're going to keep our eye on this as it develops, and you'll be hearing about it throughout the day. But, I mean, I think maybe we better talk about this for at least a couple minutes. Brian, as you pointed out a little while ago, the economy is the most important issue to President Trump. And this has got to be something that he and the people on his campaign and in the White House are looking at with grave concern.
Yeah, as well as the 50% of Americans who own stock, you know, and I'm one of those. I've been watching those for the last 20 minutes that we've been talking with some concern. I think one thing that a benchmark that we need to look at is where was the market on the day that President Obama stepped down and President Trump took effect. Before this morning, even though there had been a precipitous drop over the last couple of weeks, the market was still 30% higher than it was on the day that President Trump took office, which is a great talking point. But if it continues to fall and gets closer to that level, you take away what has been a great feather in the cap of President Trump. So obviously, they are going to be very concerned. And obviously, what the Federal Reserve has tried to do to alleviate concerns isn't working right now. So here's the other question. So we've got this situation where many people are withdrawing from the marketplace, not going to events or taking trips or going shopping because they're worried about coronavirus. Some people aren't going to school or to work. How many people further, like, don't even do online shopping because of the impact on the wealth effects? When people's stocks are going up, they feel much more comfortable about buying a new car, buying expensive clothes, et cetera. When that wealth effect goes down, the consumerism goes down. That could further inflame this issue.
So Jim, I think it's important that we look at this not just from the perspective that Brian gave us, which is perfectly reasonable, but the stock market is of little concern to people who are not invested in the market, who are trying to get by day in and day out. And so in many ways, that's an entirely different way to look at the economy right now, which is what might happen to jobs as a result of this. It's more than just those people who have investments.
Yeah, it is. But it's also, I mean, it's anyone who has a 401k, anyone who has a pension, and granted, not everyone does. But you're right. I mean, this is the ripple effect is something you worry about. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal report right now, and basically what happened with that, you had the S&P 500 fall 7%, and it triggered what they're calling a circuit breaker. in just an automatic. This wasn't a real live human making the decision. This was something that was set in place.
Look. And I think also you have to think about the small business owners, and I count myself among them. My husband and I were having this conversation just the other day. It's like he has a corporate job. It's like if you don't go to work, you still draw a salary, so it's not, you know, panic for you. If I don't go to work, if I don't get out there and do my job, I don't get paid. Yeah. And I know that's what's going through the minds of a lot of small business owners, you know, who may be in retail or who may, you know, be consultants, is that, wow, like, what's ahead for me?
All right. Go ahead. You get in here, Jeremiah.
Yeah, I would just say even more so than that. I mean, it's the people working at the retail stores. It's the low-wage, mm-hmm. minimum-wage workers who literally can't miss a day of work because they don't get paid. And if they don't get paid, that's a bill they can't pay. Or people, even worse, people who are forced to come into work because the managers should say, you're on the schedule, you need to come in. It doesn't matter if you're coughing or not. They are forced to come in, and that spreads it even worse. But, I mean, I think with this stock market decline, that is true. I mean, everything is based on, you know, investors' confidence in the market. And it's not because anything has necessarily materially changed that, you know, there's suddenly like 10% fewer sales are happening or anything like that. It's people guessing at what's going to happen in the future. And those guessing games where people trade hundreds of thousands, millions, billions of dollars ultimately will impact the jobs of people who make $7.25 an hour. And they're the ones who are going to suffer the most. The people with, you know, tons of investment in the stock market, they're going to be fine either way. But their panic is really going to hurt people who actually need the money.
All right. We will all keep our eye on this as the day goes on. Let's go back to state politics for a few minutes, because clearly the 2020 election is still terribly important. When you looked at qualifying and I saw the various stories that came out of it, what were some of the things that really struck you as being particularly interesting?
Well, number one, you have 20 people signed up to challenge Kelly Loeffler. And for her U.S. Senate seat, 20 people. Yeah. I mean, can you I'm supposed to get on the line with the Atlanta Press Club on Tuesday. How do you handle debates for that?
Yeah,
you can't just have two. You've got to have three to make any headway there. You had some very, very interesting primary challenges jump up. Jeff Mullis, the Senate Rules Chairman out of Chickamauga, he's getting a challenge from State Representative Colton Moore. That's unusual. You have an old hand, Buddy DeLoach. He used to be he's on the coast over in Hinesville. He used to be a state rep here. He's challenging the Republican current state rep Jeff Jones of Brunswick. And plus, you know, my goodness, you had that judicial race that was called off, a statewide race for the Supreme Court that was called off because of a judge's decision, announcement that he's going to resign on November 18th.
And therefore give Governor Kemp the opportunity to appoint until 2022 someone to fill that seat. Lori, the other interesting thing here, among many other things, is that although that Senate race number two has now got a huge number of people competing, the May primary contest for David Perdue's seat, David Perdue drew no Republican opponents. He is through to the general election and can begin focusing his campaign on November already.
I don't think that's surprising considering his war chest. I mean, who was going to go up against that?
Yeah.
So I don't see that as surprising at all. I think that a lot of Republicans feel that that is maybe a safer seat than, you know, Kelly Loeffler hanging on to hers.
Yeah. Brian, going to Senate race number two, as Jim just pointed out, it's a packed field now. So we're all going to be sitting here well into December talking about the runoff for that race. There's virtually no way with that many people on the ballot that you're going to get a majority in the November 3rd election.
And if you look at what the attacks from the National Republican Senatorial Committee against Doug Collins have been, they have focused on the idea that Collins is putting the seat at risk, that because of that fight a Democrat could emerge and get 50+1. I think they're going to need to drop that line of attack because nobody's going to find that believable. Yeah. I mean, this is just going to be it's going to be a bit chaotic. I mean, to Jeff's point about the 20 candidates on the debate stage, here's my suggestion. Don't have 20 candidates on the debate stage. Many of these are going to be gadflies.
You got to go by the polls, just the Democrats doing the presidential race.
You've got to look to see who is viable.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, to do otherwise is a disservice to the voters because, you know, look what you have with the Democratic presidential race when they had 20+ candidates. No one could emerge because it was just noise, you know, and you ended up having really unfortunate instances like some of the Senator Harris attack on Joe Biden about busing. You know, people just trying to break out by doing things that probably for the whole party aren't politically smart.
Okay. Jeremiah, one other fascinating note in all of this is that John Lewis has drawn a Republican opponent. And she is Angela Stanton King. Mm-hmm. She was a cast member on Real Housewives of Atlanta. She also was convicted for her part, conspiracy, in an auto theft ring, went to prison. She was one of the people President Trump pardoned recently. And she has now decided to run as a Republican. She won't face Lewis in the primary, of course, mm-hmm. but she will presumably be out there waiting for him. She is Alveda King's goddaughter, and like Alveda King, shares her belief that abortion must be outlawed. She says, I have all the respect in the world for what John Lewis did in the civil rights days, but we have a new civil rights battle that's for the unborn child.
Yeah, I mean, she's welcome to run in Georgia's 5th District. I don't know that anyone with an R next to their name in Georgia's 5th is going to pick up much traction. That being said, I think this is a great opportunity for her to get her name out and probably sell some more books. There's obviously not a viable path for her to win this race, but she will be able to stir up a lot of noise in a year where there's already a lot of noise as well.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point, Lori, is that there's going to be attention paid to her as a result of this.
I think so. And I think, you know, it brings up the issue of abortion again. But it is, as Jeremiah said, it is the 5th Congressional District. We've seen Congressman Lewis draw some Democratic challengers in years past. I mean, Mabel Thomas, Markell Hutchins, and to no avail.
And this year as well, he has a Democratic challenger.
I disagree with all three of you guys.
Brian Robinson says Fulton County is turning red.
No, I agree with the part about viability. What I disagree with is the ability to make noise. The fact is, nobody cares about congressional races anymore, and that's even more so when it's a safe seat for one party or the other. No one's going to give this candidate, and God bless her for trying. I'm glad to see a Republican woman, particularly a minority Republican woman, getting into this. That's great for the party. So, visuals, it's a good visual. It's good imagery for us. We need to do more recruiting like that. So I'm very happy to see it happen, but it's not going to be possible for her to get much attention.
Do you think there's a dearth of reality stars in the party right now? Because I am happy to see more of them being added as well.
The president is a reality star.
Really? Jeremiah's point.
No kidding. Yeah. Jim, let me first point out before I ask you the next question that Brian Robinson, who to some extent makes his living on congressional races, has just told us that nobody cares about congressional races
anymore. Ask Lucy McBath and Karen Handel.
But even they don't get much media coverage.
Jim, one other quick note before we have to take our break. In kind of running in parallel with the incredible qualifying numbers that we saw is early voting numbers. As of Friday morning, reporting out of the Secretary of State's office, which had 4 days of early voting numbers, had more than 80,000 people had taken ballots. I mean, that's an astonishing number of people in early voting. And the profiles of those people, the demographics, are interesting, too.
Do elucidate, because I have not checked that site.
Okay.
What were the 2016 figures?
Well, the 2016, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I do know that these numbers, I think, are more than double what we saw, and well more than double. And what's interesting about them, Lori, is, and I know you were out of town last week, more white voters than African-American voters, more older voters, and that's not quite as surprising, than younger voters. These, by the way, are people voting, I should have said, in the presidential preference primary, March 24th. And good deal more women than men. You can only go so far in speculating on what it means, but some of those numbers are good for Joe Biden.
I would say so. I mean, I think it's a foregone conclusion, unless something happens, that Joe Biden wins Georgia big,
yeah.
Just like he did in South Carolina. But also, I think people are turning out, too, because we've got these new voting machines. And I think people don't want to wait till the last minute. They want to make sure that their vote is counted. And they want to make sure that, you know, how these things work. They want to see them firsthand up close. I think that might play into it as well.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. When we come back, a lot more on Political Rewind. Let me update you again. Now, as of 9:53, trading has resumed on the New York Stock Exchange. Markets are hovering right around 2,000 point. Drop. So again, people will be watching that throughout the day today. Another quick update. Governor Kemp is going to hold a news conference at 4:15 this afternoon to update the state on where we stand with coronavirus. We're waiting for the testing to come back on six individuals, I believe, who have been targeted for possible exposure to the virus and perhaps to have COVID-19. We're going to stream that at gpb.org/virus so people can watch it when it happens. Laurie, let's talk very briefly with the time we have left. Tomorrow, huge day. Six more states vote in presidential primaries. It's kind of being called Mini Super Tuesday. The one that everybody's keeping their eye on is certainly Michigan. It's a showdown between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
It was. And 4 years ago, if you remember, Bernie Sanders won over Hillary Clinton, which kind of gave him kind of a rebirth in his campaign. He's hoping for that again. I think he's canceled several other campaign stops and is solely focused on Michigan. But if you look at the latest polling, and we saw Senator Cory Booker come out and endorse Joe Biden today, I think if you look at the latest polling, it is an uphill climb for Bernie Sanders. And I think in a lot of ways, it's kind of make it or break it. Because I think if Joe Biden does well tomorrow and has the momentum coming out of this mini Super Tuesday, I mean, he's definitely the one to stop.
Yeah, Jim, I think Laurie puts it in perfect perspective. 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton was expected to win Michigan by as much as 20 points, which is right now what the most recent polling is showing Biden leading Sanders there. He shocked the nation by beating her by about a point and a half, and it kept his campaign alive, and he ran it all the way to the convention.
And what's telling is who he's who Sanders is giving up in order to hold on to Michigan.
Yeah.
He's abandoning Mississippi, for instance.
Yeah, where Biden seems to have a lead of like 40-some percent. He's giving up Missouri. At least he's not competing in Missouri. Washington State, though, Jeremiah, is a state where Bernie Sanders has the ability to pull out some delegates, but he's not out there either. He's been in Michigan for the entire weekend.
I mean, I think you look at Washington, it looks like safer territory. I can't say off the top of my head just how well he did in 2016, but I know he did quite well. Washington's a state where, very interesting, they do mandatory mail ballots as well. So I think in any case, we have higher turnout, I think, because, you know, 18 to 29-year-olds, people under 45 are less likely to turn out than people over 45. If they are given an opportunity to easily and simply cast their ballot, then you're going to see more of them voting. You're going to see Bernie Sanders support go up in those places.
Brian, how are you watching this unfold tomorrow?
Well, I hate to just go along with the conventional wisdom, but I agree that Michigan is the key. You know, you've got Bernie out there pushing the trade message, saying that Biden has been for these free trade deals that have decimated the industrial Midwest. It worked, presumably, in 2016 when he pulled off an upset win against Hillary Clinton there. It's one of the things that kept his campaign alive and stretched out that campaign, which really did end up hurting the Democrats in the long run. But it looks today like Biden has come from behind once again. You know, Bernie did have a lead in Michigan. Now Biden has taken a lead and, according to some polls, has taken a massive plus 20-point lead. If you see a blowout there, this thing is over. You know, I was so excited about where Georgia was in the electoral game this year. We weren't Super Tuesday. We were kind of going to be alone later in the month. The campaign looked to be likely to stretch out because there were so many candidates who are well-funded. But now it looks like by the time our voters get a say, Joe Biden will be the presumptive nominee, if he's not so already.
Galloway?
Look, I can't remember the last election day that was preceded by the closing of the New York stock market.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to have a tremendous effect on Tuesday voting. Again,
you would suggest people are going to look for somebody who they believe they can trust and is stable tomorrow.
They are not going to be looking for a revolutionist. They're looking, they will be looking for somebody who's going to preserve this or get us back to the status quo, what we all thought was the status quo. So I think this is it could be a dreadful night for Bernie Sanders.
Well, we'll certainly watch it play out. One other quick note, Jim, let me give it to you because we've got very little time. But there was an important lawsuit that was settled at the end of last week or over the weekend, actually, that has to do with absentee ballots and would require counties to avoid problems that we've had in the past with people not being notified soon enough that their absentee ballot has been rejected. The agreement that has been reached would mandate that election officials have to, within 3 days of rejecting an absentee ballot, let the voter know that the ballot has been rejected. And if it's 11 days or closer to an election, they have to do it within 24 hours. That's a big victory for people who worried about voter suppression in terms of absentee ballots, particularly in Gwinnett County.
It is. It is. And especially when these decisions were being made on exact match.
All right. That's it. We're completely out of time. Galloway, thank you for saying that. Jim Galloway, Lori Geary, Jeremiah Olney, and Brian Robinson, thank you for a show that evolved as we were on the air. Everybody, we'll be back again.
Devolved.
Yeah, devolved. We'll be back again tomorrow. Join us then.